Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the General Government and Transportation Committee, Thursday, February the 15th, 2001. And at this time, I'm going to open up first an informational meeting dealing with the cleanup on the Highway 20 spill. We'll do that. And Pastor, I understand we have some folks here to kind of give us a report, and then we have someone in the audience. Do we have a sign-up sheet out there, too, on that?
I don't think so, Senator, because it's not a public hearing. We do have three people in the audience ready to testify, I believe. The first one is Keith Anderson from DEQ, Mike Zolich from DEQ, and Bob Wood from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Mr. Wood is the District 4 Maintenance Manager. So if those three could come up and testify, we'd thank them.
Welcome. I'll let you folks decide who's going to go first, and state your name for the record, and then proceed.
Great. Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Keith Anderson. I'm the Western Region Cleanup Program Manager for DEQ. I understand that you're interested in an update on this spill, and more of a status update. Is that accurate?
That's correct. This committee is going to be looking into a lot of preparedness issues. And when I first received the phone call, you know, relative to the spill that was in my district, I started down through the chain of command, then was, you know, present, you know, at on the Sunday following the Saturday spill, and was a little bit concerned about response time. And so, and of course, you know, how the current status, I did get a report this morning. But one of the things we're going to be looking at, and if you could kind of maybe deal with that, is the idea of how currently, it seems to take a little while to get things activated. And what we're hoping to do is have come out of this whole hearings that we're going to be doing, from seismic issues to new Carissa type issues with some bills that are coming, is to see if we cannot be better prepared for a quick response. And so if each of you could kind of go through the history, if you see some weak points, things we maybe need to work on. One question that I had, and I'm sorry that we do not have the person here from the response cooperative, as to whether or not, I'll just ask you guys maybe to address this if you have an opinion, and I know you may have to be careful not to speak for your agency, as to whether the state should in fact be a member of that cooperative. That's just my thought, as so that we could activate them immediately, because it does seem to be a chain of command that has to be met. In the meantime, we had oil running into the river. So with that, would we look forward to hearing your report and your opinions, and go ahead and proceed.
Chair George, to answer your last question first, regarding the response co-op and whether we should be part of that, that really is kind of a programmatic issue, and Paul Sliman, our ECD administrator, would probably be the best person to respond to that and could do that more effectively than I can. In terms of the actual response to this spill, it always seems that things are taking longer than you want when you have things going on. This spill, we feel we did a really good job on, actually. We had the after-hours responder on the phone making contact with people that needed to be contacted. DEQ's role is not as first responder. We're not like a local fire department to go out, you know, first thing.
Let's kind of maybe follow through the chain of events. You had initially, at 2:15, I think the accident occurred. Toledo Fire Department then responded. Hazmat was probably then called. And then what they told me is then they contacted DEQ. And so it might be good for the committee to see kind of how that response mechanism worked, if you can.
Sure.
If not, we're going to have further hearings and not a bit of problem. But
okay. I'll give you what I have today, it's, you know, our approximation of what we understood from the initial response through to probably when you were on scene. We got the call from the Oregon Emergency Response System around 2:50 regarding the tank truck. At that point, it was unknown what the contents of the vehicle were. Shortly after that, the U.S. Coast Guard was notified, and they do have two folks stationed at the Coast Guard station there in Newport who have limited response capability, but were rolled out pretty rapidly. I understand that the Toledo Fire Department was the incident commander initially. They were first on scene. DEQ you know, as we were notified, wanted to make sure we had other contacts being made. That's really one of our primary roles in the initial phase of a spill response, is making sure we have all the right resources mobilized. And that's one of the things we attempted to do. And that's what we can do best, actually, for, you know, via phone rather than trying to be en route to the spill and running out of cell range and those sort of issues. So our initial response to these things is to go out and make sure that, that you know, utilizing the resources that ORS has, we have all the right contacts being made, including Fish and Wildlife, Department of Ag. You know, we knew that there were oyster beds downstream and that there are other resources that are threatened by these kind of events. So we want to make sure we have all the resources mobilized. By about 3:45, apparently, we have ORS completing all those notifications. We've got Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Lincoln County Emergency Management, Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, Office of Emergency Management, Oregon State Police, Poison Control, 911, and U.S. Coast Guard were all folks that were apparently notified by 3:45. Later on, the Federal Emergency Management Association and EPA were notified. We have, shortly after 4 o'clock, we have indications that we have ODOT and a local spill contractor en route to the scene. At 5 a.m., we have indication that there's whatever was in the vehicle. At this point, still not clear what was in the vehicle. There's product reaching the river. The fire department has control of the scene initially, and that's important. We're looking at people's safety.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience with these events, it's a lot of confusion around the initial phases of these. And consequently, until you're confident that you can be safe with the people who are in working on the spill, it's really difficult to expect to have people going down and getting involved or getting in contact with the material that's been spilled. By 6 o'clock, the after hours person who was located in our Portland in the Portland area has contacted WestGAB, who I believe you met, Chair George, to mobilize him and get him headed out. By this time, we're getting a better feel for what's on the ground, what the status is, and the fact that there is going to be a safe command center for West to go to. He's rolled out. We have Chris Coffin, who's the gentleman working the after hours, continuing to make sure we have phone contact and are getting updates on what the status of the situation is. Wes got out there, I guess, within 2.5 hours of being contacted. And we feel like that's a pretty good response for an event that occurred at 2 or 2:15 to have somebody from DEQ on scene by 9 o'clock, that was pretty good. One thing I'll back up, Lieutenant Jason Smith with U.S. Coast Guard had arrived on scene earlier. He is a first responder. He has some additional Coast Guard resources that are available to him that he brought to bear on this as well.
In fact, he brought the booms that got into the water first.
That's correct.
Set of booms,
right? That's correct. He was on scene between 6 and 7 a.m. Once the Toledo Fire Department cleared the site for people to access it and try to evaluate what really we had, very shortly after that, people were getting the booms in the water and putting the containment booms up. And we felt real strongly that that initial containment effort did a good job of capturing a lot of the material that had gone in the river. There was, based on subsequent evaluation of the wreck scene, the material that was being transported is a real heavy bunker oil, and it's transported at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's in order to be able to offload it from the truck.
Right.
Apparently, the accident resulted in pretty much catastrophic failure of the larger tank.
It ruptured through the outer skin, through the insulation, and
the whole
right
mess,
the tank.
And that pretty much shot that stuff out and was over the side of the road, over the bank, and getting into the river pretty quickly, unfortunately. The containment, however, looked like it was doing a really good job of catching that stuff. We had several booms set in different locations downriver. By time Wes got it on site, those booms were in the water, and people
did a good job. Wes is a spill contractor?
Wes, I apologize. Wes is our DEQ's on-scene coordinator, state on-scene coordinator.
Right, okay.
That's correct. Northwest Firefighters was a contractor that was that responded to this initially. They and the U.S. Coast Guard staff worked together to get the initial booms in the water. we had, in essence, the containment that was available and appropriate in the water, you know, within 7 hours of the event being reported. And, you know, given the fact that it's cold and dark all the way up until, you know, pretty close to 7 a.m., we felt that we were doing the best we could to get the response that was necessary in place. And we feel pretty happy with that way that went. The operator, the owner of the truck was very cooperative, very helpful, very interested.
We've heard that, yes, from several people. Have been very cooperative.
And that really makes a great big difference in spill response in terms of being able to respond effectively. That helped us out, the fact that Coast Guard was rolled out early and had some folks in place, the fact that Northwest Firefighters had some manpower ready to go, in good shape, and the fact that we had good coordination in terms of making the right contacts from, you know, via phone, and then, you know, had people on scene pretty rapidly, made a big difference in how this went. We were able to do a good job of containing the material and then reacting as circumstances, you know, became apparent, as changing circumstances in terms of how the material was behaving, different river conditions and things like that. So
very fortunate that river was so low that day.
It's hard to be thankful for having a dry year, but it's, you know, in this case, it really made a difference to us.
Yes, Senator Messley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've not been in a major accident such as you're talking about, but I have seen emergency situations such as the New Caressa and flooding situation. But what I'm curious about is the protocol for who's in command and when they're in command and the first response and that type of thing, because I think, at least from the experiences I've had, that is where the breakdown is. Sometimes you lose focus at any given point who is in command of the process. And could you kind of run, in your case, how that worked? I assume that the fire department was the first on the scene, and I would hope that they were in command at that point, and then how does that work from there?
Chair George, Senator Messley, we did have the fire department in control of the scene as first responders, as the initial folks on the scene. They're running the scene up to the point where they feel like it's safe for the environmental folks to get in and begin to do their work. The handoff for command is designed to go to one of three folks that respond to spills of this magnitude. One would be the on-scene coordinator for the responsible party. In this case, I believe Charlie Tyndall was the gentleman who was there on scene representing Blue Line. The state on-scene coordinator, Wes Gebb in our case, or a federal representative. And my understanding of how this went was that Toledo Fire Department handed off to Lieutenant Jason Smith with U.S. Coast Guard, who as first federal representative on scene was the guy in charge. As it became apparent that Blue Line had the interest and the willingness and the ability to take it on, then we commonly have the responsible party take over the command. What we also do, though, is closely monitor, both with the state on-scene coordinator and the federal on-scene coordinator, how the spill response is progressing, and we certainly have similar interests, but we have some refinements that we bring to the party that sometimes responsible parties don't recognize initially, and that's our role, both as federal and state on-scene responders, to be able to let the responsible party know what our needs are in terms of responding to other resource trustees or, you know, the need to get a transportation corridor reopened and those sort of things.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. I think you're getting to the exact thing I'm concerned about, and I'm not being critical of your operation. Sounds like you responded very well. But you, I heard a lot of we's and they and the Coast Guard, and what I'm really interested in, I can understand how your interest would be in getting the corridor opened up again. But from the experience, again, as I've had, is you need someone who has very clear protocol, who is in charge at every minute, and you know, and really you need someone that follows through to, that is the commander of the operation. And then everyone else feeds into that. And in the new Carissa's case, when that chain of command started breaking down is when we started having problems. And there were some real goofy, crazy things happen, such as take the kids out of school in the middle of the day and send them home and there's no one home, and those kind of things started happening. So I'm very concerned that in your type of an accident, as well as any kind of a disastrous type situation, that I think the state needs to really work on how that protocol works and who's in command at all times and how you pass that command on.
Senator, that is, you know, today we're going to get a report on how the scene was managed, and there certainly is no criticism directed at anyone here, but there was one thing that came up initially, and we don't have anyone here from Toledo Fire Department, and that was, why didn't they act on that fire when the cab, when the truck rolled over? If you guys saw the pictures, the cab and the first trailer went upside down. The cab was on fire with the driver inside. And it was, I believe, after 7 o'clock, before Toledo, from 2 o'clock until basically 7 o'clock, that before that scene was released for anyone to go in. But when I ask a question of one of our trucking association representatives as to whether or not all of the required D2 and hazmat placards were on the trailer, the answer was yes. Did you guys, were you able to ask why we didn't know it was bunker fuel? Because I didn't realize that those numbers reflect exactly what's in the tanker until I talked with the trucking industry folks about it. And I should know that because I think I have a hazardous substance on my CDL license. But anyway, now that everyone in the building knows that, the question is that did anyone respond as to why they didn't catch the number and say, hey, we're dealing with bunker fuel, let's get this fire out and get on to capturing this oil?
Chair George, I don't know the answer to that. And it's my understanding also that placards were you know, visible on the vehicle, although I did see some photos that made that look pretty horrific. I don't have an answer for you.
Okay. Because I believe it was Wes that showed me the pictures that he'd taken with a digital camera. You can clearly see the placards with all the numbers on the trailer. Okay, because as Senator Messerly is saying, what we're doing here, and nobody's going to get blamed or anything like that, but we want to make sure we're going to have this happen again. We've had trains roll into the rivers. Well, one of the reasons this is so critical is because we're trying to restore our salmon runs, and every business in the state's being affected by this. Most of our highways follow the river because that's where the grades were light. All the rail follows those rivers because that's where the grades were light. And so the issue is that, are we prepared? Do we have resources in regional areas ready to respond? And I'm going to ask this question right now because you may have an idea. What does a set of booms that would span the average river in Oregon cost? They didn't look that expensive. And that was one of the questions we had is, could you place these resources in regional areas, such like at the end of Highway 20, up 20, Highway 8, that sort of thing, where you would have response equipment?
I don't buy boom regularly.
I'm going to find that number out.
My understanding is that it's around $100 a foot for that kind of boom.
Okay.
And in this case, the initial material that came out of the Newport Coast Guard trailer was around 250 feet, and you know, for parts of the equipment in that location, you know, that's probably adequate for a boom. In terms of the ultimate amount of boom that was out, I think I saw one number that's about 3,400 feet of boom at one point, and then as it was staged down, it's come down from there. But so there are geographic response plans in, you know, like estuary areas. Senator Messerly probably remembers some of that from the new Carissa. We have stuff staged in Coos Bay. We have a limited amount of material staged in Newport, primarily, of course, associated with waterways where there's significant potential for that sort of stuff to be needed. I don't know if that answers your question in terms.
That's good. And I will get that, because that was about what I'd estimated it cost. I was looking at it when we were down there and thought, I bet it cost about this much. Senator Carter.
Mr., can you tell me if in the state of Oregon, if there is a cross-jurisdictional group of people, task force or whatever, so in cases of emergency of that nature, these people are the first responders?
Chair George, Senator Carter, we do have a number of folks. I wouldn't say it's a cross-jurisdictional task force, but we have frequent spill drills with folks that include EPA, the U.S. Coast Guard, folks. These are primarily associated with marine terminals. Coos Bay, we've had them, and Portland Harbor, companies that work in those areas. We do have a group that gets together and works through those drills. Mike Zolich, my colleague, probably could answer that a little better. I don't know.
Mike, let me tell you my reason for asking that, because I think we're going to continue to have, when I hear these gentlemen saying, the senators up here, that it sounds like everybody's wondering who's going to be in charge, you know, and that, I'm sure, is probably determined in terms of whether it's a federal highway, state highway, local highway, whatever it is. But it seems to me that we should have something that is cross-purposed in terms of a group of people across jurisdictional lines that are all serving the purpose, and that is Oregon. And so how do we have somebody that we can say, we feel safe because this group of people are in charge here? We know there's a command center. We know that we can depend on somebody being in charge, that the state, the city, the county, the feds can come back and say, this is a group in charge, so that people won't stumble over each other. Because I'm sure when something is disastrous of this nature, there is a chain of command. And I think if you had somebody of a cross-jurisdiction line of people together that make up the force that deals with hazardous issues in this state, I bet it would be a much more complementary group of people, not worrying about who's in charge because you know who's in charge.
Senator George, or Chair George, Senator Carter, there is actually a lot of things going on.
For
the record, this is Mike Zolich. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. The state has the Oregon Emergency Response Council, which is the state police, Department of Energy, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Transportation, many of the state agencies, fire marshal,
yeah.
Get together, and that's also our huge communication link for all the agencies to get together. There's also the state marshal and DEQ sponsor, the Interagency Hazard Communication Committee, which is a link to our local emergency planning commissions and the Oregon State Emergency Response Commission. Those groups, as well as the department, the Coast Guard, and EPA, all endorse the National Interagency Incident Management System, which you often hear quite often the term unified command described. And this whole system starts with the command. The unified command, in our case, quite often consists of a federal on-scene coordinator, state on-scene coordinator, and the responsible party, because we bring the local expertise, know what the resources are at risk to that command. The responsible party really brings the money to provide the cleanup to the party. There is a very intricate system that gets into planning, logistics, finance within that command system, operations being one of the key areas, and then how you break it down, the whole chain of command. In this particular case, DEQ does have access to contractors that can respond to on-water incidents. We considered doing that at one point, but as in all of our cleanup projects, we give the opportunity to the responsible party to pretty much clean up their own mess unless they're unwilling or not capable of doing that. Again, in this case, at the Aquinnah River, we assessed, and it's our staff's responsibility to understand the response capabilities of the people at the response and encourage the responsible party to hire people with on-water experience. In this case, happened to be Cal-IT's Clean Sweep, who have received a lot of on-water training through the co-op that Chair George mentioned before.
The co-op is in existence now in result of legislation in 1989 that we took a look at the largest carriers of petroleum in the state, which are the large ships and the petroleum facilities, and looked at ways to protect those and be prepared for emergencies. The co-op is very generous in knowing that they have millions of dollars of resources to protect the navigable waters of the state, and they'd like to see those resources used as much as possible, not just for themselves. And so at incidents such as Coos Bay, you saw their wildlife resources coming down. At Yaquina River, their brand new mobile command unit was made available to us. And we have a very close relationship with the cooperative. And to answer your question earlier, yes, we can get access to all their equipment, provided you know, certain agreements are made. But it pretty much only takes a phone call. And so we actually benefit in other parts of the state from this effort that's being made in the Portland Harbor, Columbia River, and coastal protection areas.
Senator Messer, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm not trying to break in here.
My question was this. You know, if we had been a member of the co-op, what we would have done is, just like the person who showed up at the scene of an accident, and there's people who are injured, you get them in the ambulance, and you get them to the hospital for treatment, and you worry about sorting out who has what insurance later. And the thought being is that, you know, it was 13 hours later before the bulk of the booms actually arrived on scene to get out there. And what I understand is they could have been there in probably by 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And if, what I'm asking is, if we were one of the groups, in other words, as Senator Messer was alluding to or stating, is that when we decide somebody needs to roll this equipment, this stuff is going into the river, could we have then, if we had been a member, rolled that equipment immediately to the site?
Chair George, if it wasn't so much of being a member as the state having the resources to say we will respond first to these types of spills and sort it out later. At this point in time, due to the way the law is written, we must give the responsible party the opportunity to respond before we make that decision.
So that's a condition of statute that says that we will follow that procedure? Rather than
I'd have to see if that's statute or rule, sir.
Would you do that for us? Because that may be where our heartburn is. Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've talked a lot here about the booms and how effective they are. Could you or someone at the table here respond to how effective those booms are? It's my understanding that it makes a big difference what kind of material you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And I would guess with bunker oil, it probably globbed up pretty good, so you could contain it. But I know in the case of the new Carissa, even when it got clear around inside the bay, the booms looked good and made everyone feel good, but it was my understanding that they really didn't have that much effect. And so I think sometimes when we think that the booms are going to be the answer, if it's a light oil such as diesel or gasoline or something, it probably has very little impact. I mean, it does some good. I understand that. But as far as being the biggest solution to the problem, it really isn't going to make that much difference.
Chair George, Senator Messerly, we that's absolutely true. We have a boom that, in the case of the Yaquina River spill, we had a couple different kinds of boom. There's absorbent boom, which is, you know, intended to pick up those lighter fractions like gasoline and diesel. It, really not very effective except for the stuff that's stuck to it. In this case, based on how this material was behaving initially when it was still fresh in the river, it did look like it was floating and it did look like it was accumulating, and we did get really good containment of a lot of the material behind the booms. In this case, it isn't the be-all and end-all for petroleum releases, but it's one of the best tools we have, and it was utilized very effectively here. Another thing that was utilized subsequent to that, which I know you're familiar with from the new Carissa, were these what they call pom-pom snares. It's basically, you know, just like it looks like a pom-pom, it's all absorbent material that does a really good job of capturing the oil and then not letting it go. And we had strings of those across the river eventually. In fact, an idea that I understand originated with you, Senator George, was the shrimp net for the material that was starting to ball up and fall out. And that in combination with the pom-pom snare was very effective. As material changed over time, got colder and coagulated and started dropping a little bit, we were able to get good capture with that. So you're absolutely right, Senator Meschley. The boom is not the be-all and end-all, but it is a very effective tool and the tool that's readily available for us in oil-related products.
Senator.
Thank you. What percentage of the oil that was released was captured?
Chair George, Senator Meschley, we'll probably never know exactly because there's masses of that are glommed onto these pom-pom snares. There's boom that's oiled. There's material that gets picked up in even the personal protective equipment of the people who are working in the river. The material that we can actually count and quantify was the material that was vacuumed off the river surface and transported to a re-refining location. Of the 5,800 gallons that was ultimately determined to have gone, was determined to escape the vehicles, we had just over 3,300 gallons in the first load. I know there was a second, much smaller load of material that I didn't get the actual volume on. And then there's significant volume of soil, and it seemed like it was about 158 tons of soil, oil contaminated soil that was transported and disposed of offsite. And I can't, it's really hard to quantify that level. So, over 50% for sure, and then whatever incremental piece we had that was bound up in soil and in the pom-pom snare and the other debris, oil soaked debris that was removed from the river.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. By the way, I need to give credit where credit is due. Monday following the accident, I was in the building and I saw my friend Terry Thompson, former Representative Terry Thompson. And I said, asking if he'd been out to the scene, and he said, no, he hadn't been able to get there. And I said, well, we're having trouble getting that stuff picked up. The suctions were not doing a very good job, particularly where the head was high and they couldn't lift it. And he said, yeah, it's a real simple thing. He said, just get a fine mesh shrimp net and it'll pick it right up. And so I literally ran from Representative Thompson to my office and called you guys and said, give it a try. And we're really glad. And now that'll probably go into our toolkit of things that might be available. Because do we know how much bunker fuel is shipped? I mean, do we have categories of the quantities of given fuels that would be transported on our highways and rail? I mean, do we track that kind of stuff?
Chair George, we don't have exactly those numbers. What I can tell you is that depending on the price of natural gas, for example, the receiver of this shipment normally would run on natural gas, but the price has gone high. People are competing. So now we're seeing more shipments of bunker fuel. A study by the Oregon Department of Transportation 10 years ago showed that 5.5% of all commercial truck traffic is labeled as carrying hazardous materials. A good portion of the tanker trucks are diesel and gasoline and other petroleum products.
Okay. Great. Yes.
Chair George?
Yeah.
I don't know
if
you guys would care to look at a sample. This is some bunker fuel from the new Carissa, hold number 2, before it was contaminated or anything like that. As you can see, I mean, I can, room temperature here can hold this upside down, and it won't move for days. Very, very nasty material and does present a significant threat to wildlife should they become coated with this. And obviously cleaning up, it's not very simple at all.
Close to tar.
Yes.
Bob, how are you?
Good. Chair George, I'm Bob Wood from Oregon Department of Transportation, Senators. Doing fine. Our role in this was primarily traffic control, and that's what my staff is directed to do in incidents like this. We were second on scene. In terms of the question about incident command, we're fairly well trained in incident response command, and was already mentioned, if it's a fire, the fire department's incident command. If it's a criminal investigation, then the police are in command. If it's strictly a highway issue, then we're in charge. So at that point in time, when my staff got there, the truck was fully engulfed. The information on what material it was wasn't very clear. So fire had control of that scene, and from the folks I had on the ground out there, they felt they made absolutely the right call. Given the fact that, you know, this was could potentially be explosive,
right.
Unfortunately, because of the fire, it kept the local contractor who I'd called when I initially got the page from getting downstream. So that was, you know, really our problem there was getting them through, and we unfortunately couldn't do that until the fire was contained.
Right, because they couldn't get, you know, couldn't get by to get the road to follow the group that was through.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, any further questions? All right, I appreciate it. And I'll tell you what I'll ask you guys to do is, I don't know if this is going to take the form of legislation. I'll look forward to hearing whether or not we have the authority to act. Any suggestions as to what we do to answer the questions that Senator Messerly had? You know, when we had the new Carissa, we said we cannot allow anything like this to happen again, yet what's happening. In fact, we'll have a legislation back before the committee that may attempt to address some of these things by actually having contracts in place to make sure that we have all resources necessary to respond. So appreciate the effort. And Bob, at least we got one little piece of new road.
And then, yeah, we got some new pavement out there.
We got some new pavement, but we had to dig it out. Oh, okay. Is it okay? John Pung and Ann Harper. Okay, thank you guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
While John's coming up, I'll. I showed up down there that day at the headquarters and John and his wife live next door, I guess, and. We spent some time driving up down the river, looking at things, John has been keeping me informed as to what it looks like from a landowner's perspective. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm John Pung from Elk City Tackle, Elk City, Oregon, and this was in our backyard, and maybe we've seen things from a different perspective. I have no idea.
My name is Ann Harper, and I co-own the Elk City store with John.
All right. We started off here with a press release from DEQ, and I have a problem when they make press releases, and we have two different press releases here. This first one, I wish you'd remember the numbers. Specifically, 250 gallons of liquid oil or vacuum, 38 tons of oil-soaked soil, 38 cubic yards of absorbent spill pads. And then on the next page, the crash scene was open to state and federal cleanup officials at 7 a.m. Saturday. Now, we know that it was only... let's say 150 gallons of diesel fuel, and any truck driver that I've talked to said that this would have been burnt within 2 hours. And then we did attend a unified command meeting on the 29th. We questioned their figures that were on page one. And then page three is the start of a letter that we had to the News Times, and we have two of our letters to the News Times, and they pretty well explain the time frame. And the first letter is, this tragedy should open ODOT and our community leaders to the importance of Highway 20. Our concern has been that the incident has happened. How will HAZMAT and the rest of these emergency agencies respond in the future? Now, we had a HAZMAT employee in our store that said he was on the scene at 3 o'clock in the morning. This same kind of spill could happen anywhere, whether it be Eastern Oregon or Western Oregon. And then governmental agencies, count them, there were about 15. And they have made this area adversarial by their attitude and lack of caring. It was like, we come in here like gangbusters, and hey, they took over the area. They had no consideration for the people who lived there. And what are they going to do to make it friendly again? They've killed any friendship that could have been there, and it's really sad. And it's just like with the DEQ reports, if they would tell the truth, I could handle it. But when the stories they come up with do not coincide with what we've seen with our own eyes and the people we've talked to, there's something very wrong here. And what is the most critical time when there's a spill? Is it 10 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours? To me, it would be the first 3 or 4 hours. We know the owner of the truck received the first call about 3:15 a.m. and was in the area by 4:30. So between 3 a.m. and the time that they knew, so between 3 a.m. and that 4:30, they knew what was on that tanker. What is the truth here? And where does this put the Toledo Fire Department? The first boom should have been in that water in that time frame. If they needed volunteers, I, for one, would have been there, as many others would have been, to help contain this spill.
John, hey, we can read this, but I'll tell you one of the things. You mentioned an issue, and I think you and I talked about it on Sunday. I brought my two pair of Levi's ready to get into the river. Did you ever get a response as to, because I was told that day that we couldn't do anything as far as volunteers because of OSHA.
Right.
Did you ever get an explanation to
that? No. Nope.
That was the only explanation that we got as well.
OSHA issue. Okay, and that's something we'll probably need to check out because those of us who've handled petroleum products forever, you know, it didn't bother me to go in rubber boots and a pair of gloves. I would have been fine.
All right, let's jump a little bit here to the next page. Sunday morning we got up and the Elk City Park was a little city. Where was all of this Saturday morning? If they're going to have an emergency response, that means that they respond. We've got an emergency, and I don't care if you got a white shirt, tie, $300 pairs of shoes, you get in there and you help. And so we were told that morning there was going to be a press conference at 11 a.m. at the command trailer. We walk over and open the door of the command center. I asked where the press conference is going to be, and they said Trap Creek. And I look around, and we got 12, 15 people standing around, sitting around. My God, they're really clean. I thought we had an emergency here. And we'll jump to the bottom. Why did it take so long? The governor's office, salmon restoration. We know that salmon beds have been destroyed. Oregon Trout, Northwest Steelheaders, ODF&W, the Chamber of Commerce, environmentalists, everybody should be asking a question of why it took so long. And then
our committee is kind of going to do that, John. And the main thing, let me ask you this question, because we want to be positive here. You saw the weaknesses. You were there. You're the one that called me 6 o'clock Sunday morning?
Right.
We said, who in the world would call somebody 6 o'clock Sunday morning? I got up and answered the phone. It was John. John said, can you get down here? You need to see this. But tell us, well, you know, obviously you heard the discussion about the idea of strategically placing boom at different sites, having a command, you know, that would fully understand that you can read the numbers, determine what you've got on board. Where do you think this thing broke down? I mean, we did have an awful lot of supervisory personnel, and the folks from the clean sweep, they were working. Tell us, if you were going to try to make sure that didn't happen again, how would you handle it? What recommendations?
She's ready.
Okay.
Chairman George and Senators, I'm Ann Harper again, for the record. I believe that the training of our police department, I mean, not police departments, our fire departments are in critical need of assistance. I have heard from numerous people in talking about this situation that our volunteer fire department is clearly untrained. I mean, they're trained, but they're not trained for the emergency things. And the real emergencies, like the water and the oil, they didn't know what they were dealing with. And I'm concerned about the big one. We're talking about the seismic stuff. The last time we were here, the tsunami. If these folks aren't trained, what's going to happen with our mill? And Toledo Fire Department is going to respond to that. They're going to be first responders because that's their town. And we have other accidents that have happened on the Aquinna River, on Highway 20, and on Elk City Road, as far as that goes. And they just sit there and they look at it like they don't know what they're doing. Clearly, there needs to be someone in charge, as Senator Messerly said, and there needs to be training from the local people, particularly in places like Highway 20, where we're constantly having accidents. They need to know how to deal with a plane crash. If a plane crashes into the river, what kind of oil do they have on it? They should be trained to know what they're dealing with. And another thing that was discussed in one of the evening session was the trucking association, or the truckers should, if they are going to be traveling in an area with hazardous material, they should call the emergency center and say, we have trucks. They should be required to let them know. The emergency centers know that they are going to be coming into that particular area with hazardous material.
That is an area we're going to look at, as to whether we can improve recognition of what is being carried at what times and that sort of thing. It did appear that there was a real effort made by the trucking company to respond. And you were saying they were one of the first people on site. And we've heard they've been there, the actual owner of the company, I guess.
Absolutely.
Practically lived there. So.
They did live there for 2 weeks.
Well, we don't have a problem with them. What we have a problem with is the response. What's going to change on the next one?
Okay. Well, I'm going to assure you too that we had the hearing on the new Carissa. I came to conclusions myself as to what went wrong, very similar to Senator Messerly. We didn't take any direct action because we were told things were going to change. I think the point of it is, just like as you mentioned earlier, we're going to be dealing with the seismic issues. We're going to be talking about disaster relief funds and being prepared for things and how we're going to finance them. And so I think this, I believe, will become a major part of this committee's activities to make sure that, you know, 2 years from now, we won't be sitting here saying the same things and have similar responses.
Well, one more thing. I see Senator Messerly looking at the sheet here. There was 18 different individuals, there may be 19, in the chain of command. We watched. Now, on Sunday morning, I think Senator George would agree with that. If we thought those people were in that river really trying to control that, they would have had all the coffee, sandwiches they could have had to eat. But we watched an average of, I'd say, 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 white-collar workers towards people that were actually picking up the oil. There's something wrong here. Way wrong. And it's this whole thing is crazy. It hurt us. For 2 weeks we lost everything. Right. And it had to hurt Lincoln County. And we understand that when this bunker oil went into the river, it congealed and made a ball. And if they could have got in there with the suction trucks, even at daylight, they could have got most of that oil out of there Saturday because it was congealed in a ball. But because they didn't have the activity going on, the river worked on this and sent it downriver. And I don't believe that they said they had it contained. Have they got it contained now? There's 2,500 gallons of oil that's unaccounted for. And we'll sell tar balls real cheap.
Well, it worked with Mount St. Helens. We saw little vials full of sand. Well, thank you guys for caring about that river, and keep the heat on us to do something about this, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. Okay, I'm going to close that informational meeting dealing with a hazardous cleanup on Highway 20. And at this time, we have amendments that I understand have been are being drawn, or and we also need a review on 63 and Senate Joint Resolution 5.
That's right. With regard to the amendments, Mr. Chairman, we have now received both amendments. The problem is that subsequent revenue and fiscal analyses have not yet taken place on each of those amendments. So that's where we are. What Senate Bill, I can tell you what Senate Bill 63 is that creates a disaster relief fund to fund restoration of infrastructure and public services after disasters. It also allows a transfer of 0.5% of the state highway fund apportionments to counties and cities to fund a highway reserve account within this disaster relief fund, and it specifies purposes for which the money shall be expended. Now, the amendment to that, and by the way, there was an original revenue impact analysis done. There was no impact to the state, but the Legislative Revenue Office did estimate that the transfer into this highway reserve account would be between $1.7 and $2.6 million biennially. Mm-hmm. With regard to both the initial bill and its amendment, there have been no fiscal impact analyses yet completed for it. What the amendment would do for Senate Bill 63 is to remove the provision for the 0.5% of state highway fund dollars being transferred into this highway reserve account. So what it would do is effectively just allow for the establishment of this disaster relief fund without specifying any, you know, significant funding source for it. So that's where we are in Senate Bill 63.
Okay, before I open a public hearing, let me just ask this question. Is there anyone here that would like to testify on those two bills who would not be able to come back later when we have all of this information before us? Because we do have a person. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 63 and also SJR 5. So you'll be able to speak on one or both of those.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to provide an overview of SJR 5 before we begin the public hearing?
All right, let's do that.
Okay.
Have that.
Yep. Senate Joint Resolution 5 creates a joint interim task force to study and recommend and develop recommendations for the development and funding of disaster preparedness and hazard mitigation components of a comprehensive statewide disaster relief program. There's no revenue impact. However, there's been a slight $66,000 fiscal impact, and that's mainly for the staffing of a joint interim committee to study this issue.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Ricks. I live at the Oregon Yacht Club in Portland, which is a floating home, so I have a very close concern about the state of our rivers. Today I am testifying and submitting testimony on behalf of the Oregon organization who assist in disasters. I gave you the letter from the chairman, Noreen Goplin. I'm the vice chairman of the group, and you can see to the left the representation that makes up the, we call it ORVAD. Just to remember that to my connection, I'm retired. The past 6 years I've served as a volunteer with the Northwest Medical Teams. I served as their domestic disaster response planner. In that capacity, I participated in the recovery and cleanup of the Oregon flood, the flood in Grand Forks, North Dakota, in the North Carolina, Tarboro, Hurricane Floyd flood, and basically here in Prineville. So that our testimony basically is coming from that kind of experience. The ORVAD, very quickly, has been in operation since the 1980s. We have participated in a number of different community needs regarding disasters in Oregon, successive floods, wildfires, other community disasters. Our services mainly are provided to individuals upon the securing of a disaster of getting recovery into their own homes and to their small businesses. We've worked in close cooperation with the Federal Emergency Management Association, the Oregon Emergency Management Council, and other parts of the state, such as the Department of Transportation. The thing that we find most significant in the bill is in 63 is that we support 63 and its funding, that there is a significant need for funds to be made available to local communities to do their infrastructure and to rejuvenate, get back to where they can function in a normal capacity. However, the whole disaster system is one that starts out with planning and how we are going to respond, who's in charge, and what is their role in the planning process. In Oregon, we do have an Oregon disaster plan. We also have a Oregon donations management plan of how to handle the donated goods that are given at the time of disaster to be delivered to those that need it. We also have under work a long-term recovery plan. When a disaster occurs, such as a flood here in 1996, we were still working on case needs of individuals to help them get back into their business or back into their home or restore the roads that were washed out or even the cattle that were lost, you know, like in Tillamook, up to a year and a half after that disaster. It doesn't just stop at the minute that the disaster basically has subsided or has been controlled. For that particular reason, I want to point out that in many ways, the volunteer groups come in and work as a team with all of the other organizations. It isn't just a single entity that basically can respond. So we go from the planning stage to the response stage to the recovery stage and the relief stage. And in every that, there's different roles. I can point out that, for example, in the flooding in North Dakota, there was no water system, there was no sewer system, there was no TV. There was no radio, period. It was all water. So when the city was and the state was working on the water system, the volunteer organizations were bringing in bottled water. And those are being distributed to the people that were there to help the work. That's the only water they could get. When it came to the sewer system, the volunteer agencies brought in the portable portable systems that could be used. And the motel I was staying in, I could flush the toilet once a day. But that's what was there of helping the city while it was trying to prepare its sewage. The same thing is basically true when you're looking at homes. Again, even though we have to muck out a home down to the studs, that debris has to go somewhere. And that debris becomes the responsibility of the city and the county to pick that up and know where to put it. So again, we have to work in concert of how they want those materials placed and how they want them separated so they can dispose of them. These are just a few of the examples, and another one is down in the area of where we were working with a road that was out in Tillamook County at the Shawnee, where the people couldn't get across the river to get anywhere out of the area which where they were there. It took us about a year working with the Corps of Engineers and others to get that road reestablished and helping the farmers down there in Tillamook to restore their farms and the cattle and that area so that the dairy products could start being in use. What I'm pointing out is that two things. One, while we support the funding, on the joint resolution bill, it consists of having representation on the task force of three people from the Senate, four people from the House, one person appointed from the cities by the House, and one person appointed from the cities to the Senate. Excuse me. We have to have a team. And the Northwest Medical Team and other voluntary organizations need to be a part of that in order to make it work. We don't want to have a disaster where I think you just heard, where the lack of response, the lack of coordination, you end up having a disaster on a disaster. And that's the worst thing because the victims basically are the ones that are suffering. So we'd like to be a part of that task force and be able to provide the input that we have, the expertise that we have, so that is a complete planning process and a complete response recovery process. And we then can work in concert with them on whatever disaster basically occurs in the state of Oregon. That's our only request in support of Senate Bill 63 and hopefully an amendment to the Joint Resolution 5, sir.
Richard, first of all, I want to thank you. As I look down the list of all the things that your groups work together to problems to solve and disasters to bring relief to. I want to thank you for those efforts.
Welcome. Thank you.
Have you talked with the principals in the bill as to whether they're this is a friendly amendment? And the other thing is that that was one of the thoughts that I had, is that we shouldn't have, in fact, have that web completed as far as the framework of response. And as we talked about Y2K just recently, and as I talked with folks about from Food Share, from Fish, and other organizations like that, there does seem to be additional coordination needed,
yes.
Particularly to involve private, church response, you know, all the different ministries that might be out
yes.
there that could, in fact, cooperate.
Yeah. We have not. We found out or were aware of the bill a little over a week ago. Noreen and I came down Tuesday, and the bill wasn't here. I found out that you were hearing it yesterday. I tried to get this down here. We will try to follow it with the principles of the bill. And like with your putting $7.5 million, I think you said in the fiscal on the relief fund.
1.7 to 2.6 on 63.
Yeah, that's right. There was when they were including the transfer of state highway fund apportionments.
Yeah.
I think it was between 1.7 and $2.6 million biennially, I believe, into that account. Now the subsequent amendment then did away with that funding source, so removed it from the
I just want to, a reason I raised that question, Senator, is that during the flood in Oregon, the volunteer agencies raised $8.5 million. So we can be a participant in the fiscal recovery process. And again, hoping that money that we bring in, the money you have, goes to the greatest need.
Richard, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll see if following this hearing, we can't maybe get a group together to work on that. It'd be nice if we could bring those groups together in the bill.
We'll be happy to help you.
And I know anyone in this building will tell you the more people you have on board and supporting your bill, the better it is.
Oh, sure.
All right.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, hang on.
I was just going to say, right. Mr. Chairman, I failed to mention the proposed amendment to SGR 5. Apparently, he's not the only one who wanted to be included in this task force, because the proposed amendment to SJR 5 would be to include two representatives from special districts as well.
That the government special district?
Well,
like the school district or the water district?
I must say, because I just received this, I'm not exactly
okay.
sure what the definition of a special district. I see representative of the counties out there furiously nodding, so I suppose so. Two individuals representing special districts, one appointed by the President of the Senate and one appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Okay. I still would hope that we could have one of those voluntary from the Oregon VOAD group.
You know what I might suggest to you folks, because I don't think there's anyone else has responded that they couldn't return when we had amendments. We did have a person? Okay. What I'm going to suggest to you is maybe you guys could have a little conference outside as we move when we move on to the next issue.
Okay.
And then kind of get back to us to let us know, you know, whether we have some sort of agreement there to bring those items in. If you were not included, I think the implication would be that they would want to include later once the framework was up and emergency response was going to occur. Would you have any problem with it if that was the case?
I don't know. I would like to go back. We're having a meeting next Tuesday. I'll ask the group on that point, maybe. And I think as long as we can be part of the teamwork, we'll contribute.
Certainly looks like a great idea, particularly on your group's track records of delivering all over, not only in Oregon, but all over the world.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Do we have another person that is... We don't know who this. What I'm going to do is who cannot return when we have the amendments and would like to speak. Would you like to come on forward?
And if each of you could state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm
please.
Sorry about that. I did not do that properly.
Senator George, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I can return. However, I have two county commissioners with me today who may not be able to return, so I would like the opportunity then to testify at this point. We had initially had a presentation we were going to make and some flow at this point, but we'll, in the interest of time, kind of break that up at this point. To my right is Commissioner Tony Hyde, and to his right is Commissioner Dan Erickson. Commissioner Hyde is from Columbia County. Commissioner Erickson is from Wasco County. They are the co-chairs of the Association of Oregon Counties Disaster Relief Subcommittee at this point to create this disaster fund. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield to them, and then at the next hearing at this point, I'll be happy to make a full presentation for you.
Welcome. I'll let you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us this brief minute of time, and I'm trying to be brief. I understand that we have other issues concerning this bill, and we're going to have to come back, and hopefully I'll be able to do that, but my constituents expect me to be home as much as possible, so I'll try to say what I have to say that's most important now, and if I can, I'll be back. The one thing I wanted to say seems to be the most compelling to me is, first of all, I was the mayor of the city of Vernon in the flood of 96, so I do know what it's like to be impacted. And I, the last presenter, and I have had more than one conversation. I wish we'd had it before today. This is the first time I've heard about this, and I'm sure we can make a spot. That's not an issue. Things that he said he did, he certainly did. His organization helped our community a great deal. What I'd like to say is the bill as it's presented today gets us started. It doesn't really solve all the problems. We've been at this for some 8 years now, and we've decided that the best way to approach this compelling need is incrementally. And we think that the most important part is that we provide some segue as we look to ourselves to create funds for disaster relief, and certainly the 25% that's required from this from FEMA to access FEMA dollars is the most important piece. We need to have some sort of disaster relief fund started, whether there's a dollar or $1,000 or 20 million is not important at this point. What's important is that we establish the fund, and then we're going to go outside of ourselves, and that's what the Joint Committee Interim Task Force will do, is trying to create some funds and increase the capacity of emergency management. And I would just like to point out, I'll tell you a story about one particular issue that came up in the flood of 96. There was a number of counties that had more disaster than they could pay for, and certainly more disasters than they could come up with a 25% for their communities to access federal FEMA dollars. And we became pretty much experts on how FEMA worked in the United States. We paid a lot of attention to what happened in the Ohio Valley, and we understood that in the Ohio Valley, once they went past the $1.51 per capita, a disaster in the state, that then the federal government started to look at, well, perhaps we can relax the 25% because we understand that you have a large number of infrastructure that needs to be taken care of. So they did relax the number, and it was, I think it went to 15%, and as far as I was concerned, they set a precedent. We arranged a meeting, we meaning Oregon Emergency Management Association, Oregon Emergency Management, several counties, and David DeCourcy, who was a Region 10 director at that time for FEMA, set up a conference call meeting in Portland, Oregon, from Senator Wyden's statewide office to the FEMA office in Washington, D.C., and we had a conversation about the impact in the state of Oregon and the amount of the disaster per capita and the fact that that precedent had been set and perhaps they could relax it to 15% for the citizens in the state of Oregon as far as accessing federal funds. After some conversation, the point was made that the state of Oregon was one of six states left the United States that did not have a disaster fund, and therefore they didn't feel that the state was being proactive enough to help themselves. And the way it was put quite simply is, the state's not helping you, why should we? And that's the way they left it, and I have never forgotten that. And I've been pursuing this disaster relief fund ever since. So that, That's all I have.
Good for you. I was on a budget committee and a road advisory committee when that flood hit, and I know we were desperate. Some response. I know Federal Highway was awesome to deal with. Other things, there seemed to be, and I think Art and I shared this, the lack of framework did give them heartburn as to how to deal with each individual jurisdiction. So, okay, thank you.
Chair George, committee members, I'm Dan Erickson from Wasco County. I would concur with what Tony has said in regards to amending or including somebody else. I think our committee and the emergency management people from the state of Oregon tried extensively to include everybody in the first go-round. If we have oversights or if there's somebody else that needs to be included, I'm sure that we're willing to work with whoever. But we felt that we had most of the players at the table, and we tried very hard to put together a package that was acceptable and workable statewide, because this is a statewide need, and Columbia County, Tillamook County, the coast, somewhat the Willamette Valley, has had a lot of publicity concerning floods and disasters. I'm in Eastern Oregon, and we've had our share of disasters. The brief map that got passed around with the pictures constitute about a two-hour event that happened. It was a flash flood, unlike anything ever seen in Wasco County. Did tremendous damage in July of 95. We were able to get matching funds through a lot of help from the governor's office and from people supporting our need, even though, as Tony has said, there were some precedents set or some rules bent to get us help. Under the current system, that won't happen again. We wouldn't qualify for those funds without having some sort of statewide program. The unfortunate thing in Wasco County is that was July of 95. About 7 months later, we had the floods of 96 and went through that event over again with just about double the damage from what was there. The map that you saw, the green and red lines on that map, indicate severe damage. The pictures that go along with that are just an indication of what severe damage is. But wherever you see green and red lines, that is the type of damage that was on all of those roads. We were rebuilding those bridges after the flood of 96 when the flood of 97 wiped out those foundations of the new bridges. So it has devastated our public works budget over that period of years. We're now somewhat recovering. But as you know, our timber dollars and federal revenues have not been adequate to keep our road department funded. So we cannot survive disasters. We have a hard enough time surviving with the funding that we have. And we need some guarantee that when a disaster strikes, there will be federal assistance. And in order to do that, we need this legislation. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Well, we hope you're able to come back if you can. I think there's a good reception to the whole concept of this, particularly since that framework now appears to be mandatory. So, okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and at this point and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 60. My staff just pointed out that we may want to ask the question if there's anyone else who may not be able to return. Okay? All right. Thank you for that.
Okay. So even people who send this panel just come back and start?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to ask. We did have other people that signed up. I'm assuming that they've either left or will be able to come back. Okay. Really good. Great. Thanks, Patrick, for that. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 63 and SJR 5 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 445. Patrick, tell us where we are.
Yes, Senate Bill 445 allows a person to operate a Class 1 all-terrain vehicle on state highways when used for agricultural purposes. It creates an offense of unlawful operation of a Class 1 all-terrain vehicle used for agricultural cultural purses, and it punishes person for operating a Class 1 all-terrain vehicle in an unlawful manner by a maximum fine of $75. A Class 1 all-terrain vehicle is defined in Oregon revised statutes as a motorized off-highway recreational vehicle 50 inches or less in width with a dry weight of 800 pounds or less that travels one on three or more low-pressure tires, has a saddle or seat for the operator, and is designed for capable of cross-country travel on or immediately over land, water, snow, ice, marsh, swampland, or other natural terrain. ATVs, I'd also like to note, are not presently designed to meet on-road safety requirements set forth by the United States Department of Transportation, Oregon Revised Statutes, and the United States Environmental Protection Agency. There is a no revenue impact statement issued. There is a fiscal impact issued, not any fiscal impact to the state, but a note more or less that says that because it will allow local agencies to issue this $75 ticket for the unlawful operation of Class 1 all-terrain vehicles, that it would generate revenue for the locals. And also, I did have a request from someone to read a letter into the record, which is actually issued in opposition of Senate Bill 445.
Can I have a letter from State Police? Are they going to
send
a letter?
I didn't receive the letter from State Police. I received a letter from the Special Vehicle Institute of America. And would you like me to read that into the record?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. It was written by the Special Vehicle Institute of America and a general by the name of, actually a woman by the name of Kathy Van Cleek, and she writes that the Specialty Vehicle Institute of America is the national nonprofit trade association representing manufacturers and distributors of all-terrain vehicles in the United States. SVIA's major goal is to promote the safe and responsible use of ATVs. She notes that she is writing concerning SB 445 currently before your committee. The bill would allow ATV use on highways for agricultural purposes under certain conditions. The popularity of ATVs grew considerably during the 1980s, accompanied by an increase in accidents. The majority of accidents and injuries are caused by the misuse of ATVs, including carrying passengers, alcohol abuse, lack of a helmet or other protective gear, and riding on paved streets and highways. According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, almost 10% of ATV-related injuries and more than 25% of deaths involves operation on paved roads, despite the fact that vehicle labels and owner's manuals clearly warn against such use. Additionally, a survey by Alaska Center for Disease Control, Division of Surveillance and Epidemiologic Studies found that 63% of the ATV accidents in Alaska occurred on designated roadways. ATVs are designed and manufactured for off-road use only. On-road vehicles must be designed, built, and certified to comply with federal and state safety requirements. These safety and emission standards consist of extensive and detailed compliance requirements. Since ATVs are not intended to be used on-road, they are not designed, equipped, or tested to meet such standards. For example, ATVs are equipped with special off-road tires, and unlike off-road motorcycles that can be equipped with USDOT-approved tires, ATVs cannot be so equipped because street-legal DOT-approved tires do not exist for ATVs. Many ATVs are equipped with a solid rear axle that turns both rear wheels at the same speed. Such ATVs are not designed to turn without slipping one rear wheel. Consequently, turning an ATV on high traction surfaces, such as paved streets, can be difficult when compared to turning in the off-road environment, even if the off-road tires would be replaced by a future street-legal tire. Permitting street use of ATVs, including modified vehicles, would be in conflict with manufacturers' intentions on their proper use and would violate federal safety and emissions requirements. SVIA emphasizes that ATVs are not designed, manufactured, or in any way intended for use on public streets, roads, or highways, and urges that on-highway use of ATVs be prohibited and law enforcement.